Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 175, and we're back in the Cape circa 1849 and thereabouts. Before we dive into the latest incidents and events, let's take a look at what was going on globally, as everything was connected. In France, citizens were able to use postage stamps for the very first time in a series called Ceres, as in C-E-R-E-S, which is also a place in the Western Cape. The Austrian army invaded Hungary, entering the country's two capitals, which back in 1849 were called Buda and Pest. Next door, Romanian paramilitaries laid into Hungarian civilians, killing 600 in what we'd call ethnic cleansing. The Second Anglo-Sikh War was on the go in India, and the British suffered a defeat at the Battle of Toul, while across the ocean in Canada, the colony of Vancouver Island was established. This is important because that's where one of my ancestors eloped late in the 19th century, for that metropolis that was Beaufort West. Elizabeth Blackwell was awarded her M.D., thus becoming the first woman doctor in the United States, and the Corn Laws were officially repealed by the U.K. Parliament. These were tariffs and trade restrictions on imported food, including all grains like barley, wheat and oats. I mention this because the repeals spelled the death knell to British mercantilism. The Great Famine of Ireland between 1845 and 1852 had also revealed a real need to produce alternative food supplies through imports. It was this change that led to free trade finally being ushered into Britain, and of course this created opportunities for southern African farmers. It was also the year the first Kennedy arrived in America, a refugee of this Irish famine. More prosaic, perhaps, in New York on a cold February day, 1849, President James Knox Polk became the first president to have his photograph taken, while Minnesota became a formal U.S. territory, and the settlement of Fort Worth in Texas was founded. In July, a slave revolt at the Charleston Workhouse broke out, led by Nicholas Kelly, but plantation owners suppressed the revolt and executed three of the leaders, including Kelly. In September of 1849, African-American abolitionist and hero Harriet Tubman escaped from slavery. Also in July, French scientist Hippolyte Fizeau managed to measure the speed of light for the first time. Meanwhile, across the channel, far more savage processes were underway. Swiss-born Marie Manning and her husband Frederick were publicly hanged for the murder of her lover in London before a crowd of around 50,000 people. They had murdered Patrick O'Connor in the case that became known as the Bermondsey Horror. It was the first time that a husband and wife had been executed together in England since 1700. As it is with dishonourable people, both husband and wife try to shop each other for the crime. Charles Dickens attended the execution, and in a letter written to the Times on the same day he wrote, "I believe that a sight so inconceivably awful as the wickedness and levity of the immense crowd collected at that execution this morning could be imagined by no man and could be presented in no heathen land under the sun." Dickens based one of his characters, Mademoiselle Hortense, in Bleak House, on Manning's life. Another classic author, Herman Melville, was there. He paid half a crown for a spot on a roof overlooking the execution, he wrote later in his diary. "The man and wife were hung side by side, still unreconciled to each other. What a change from the time they stood up to be married together." Later that year, the Hungarian army of Transylvania defeated a joint Austrian-Russian army, thus liberating Transylvania from Austrian rule. While in Germany, the revolution, supported by a young militant called Karl Marx, ended in failure. In November, a Russian court sentenced Fyodor Dostoevsky to death for anti-government activities linked to a radical intellectual group. Facing a firing squad on December 23rd, the group members were reprieved literally as they stood facing the guns and exiled to the Katorga prison camps in Siberia. In 1849, the lower house of parliament of the Kingdom of Bavaria passed a bill granting German Jews the same legal rights as German Christians. This did not go down well with many Christians across Bavaria, who signed petitions in their tens of thousands urging the upper house to prevent the equal rights measure from becoming law. It goes to show just how these events are linked to our present. As we all know, historical circumstance is like a constant ripple of social ills and events. Speaking of ills, in December 1849, global healthcare and pharmaceutical company Pfizer was founded in New York. Fascinating, these events. They thunder down the ages all the way to where we sit in the 21st century. Oh, and Lord Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill's father, was born. And Edgar Allan Poe died. Symbolic in so many ways was the birth of Bertha Benz, a German automotive pioneer. Born Cecilie Bertha Ringer, she was the business partner, investor, and wife of automobile inventor Carl Benz. Later in 1888, she was to become the first person, male or female, to drive an internal combustion engine automobile over a long distance, field testing the Benz patent Motorwagen. Ms. Benz also invented brake linings, which are used in cars today, and solved other issues during the journey of 105 kilometers. In doing so, she brought the patent Motorwagen worldwide attention and secured the Benz company its first sales. Bertha Benz's financial and practical engineering contributions have long been overlooked. Sir Benjamin Durban, after whom Durban in KwaZulu-Natal is named, and one of the governors of the Cape, died in Montreal, Canada. Then, back to the Cape, because the anger at Harry Smith's new policies were curing, nay, ripening, stewing, brewing amongst the Amaxhosa. Arriving in the Eastern Cape, Harry was committed to reinstating the Durban system with which he had been associated, and which Lord Glenelg, back in the Colonial Office, had rejected. By now, Earl Grey was in the colonial hot seat back home, and he gave the thumbs up. Smith set to work sorting out the administration, appointing members of the settler elite to official positions, including Richard Southey as his personal secretary. As a close colleague of Grahamstown Journal editor and rabid anti-Xhosa Robert Godlinton, he was chosen for his anti-black bias. If you remember how Smith had arrived, placing his foot on Amaxhosa Chief Macroma's neck, and his new edicts, including the creation of British Kaffraria, the previously known ceded territory, you can imagine just how he was being regarded further east. That was the home of Sarili, the paramount chief of the Amaxhosa, the Tlaleka leader, heard that Smith had announced himself as the great chief of the people west of the Kai, but Sarili remained great chief of the Amaxhosa who lived in what was now being called the Transkei. Smith wanted sheep herders to replace cattle herding. He agreed with the missionaries that the use of cattle to reinforce Lobola and the social power of the chiefs had led to clashes and needed to change. The new British governor then made a Khoikhoi descendant by the name of Commandant Khrupa the new justice of the peace inside the Kat River settlement. It was something the missionaries had advised him to do. The Amaxhosa were expelled from the Victoria East District, the land allocated to the English settlers and the Amamfengu refugees you've heard about, but also to the important Amatembu chiefs. They were linked to the Amaxhosa royal line, and his decision created splits and fissure points in the Xhosa political system. What happened almost immediately was land speculation and absentee ownership. Some British settlers took the opportunity to establish wool farms in the northern areas of Victoria East, at exactly the spot where Macroma and Chief Sandile had once lived. The Amamfengu were upset because they had been promised more land as part of the deal for fighting alongside the British in the 1846-7 Frontier War. Smith duly allocated them more land, further exacerbating the growing friction between the Amamfengu and the Amaxhosa. Godlinton and Grahamstown went further, taking advantage of the Orange River's sovereignty. A land speculator of note, he bought 5 large farms in the Trans-Orangia region. English land speculators from Natal heard about the opportunities and bought farms across that river as well. The Boers, meanwhile, were smarting, frustrated by this, and so too were the Griqua and Adam Kok, who regarded that territory as theirs. Speculation was so rampant, within a year, by 1850, a paltry 139 men, mainly from the Eastern Cape, had bought up over 2.5 million acres of land in the Trans-Orangia region. Land prices rapidly escalated. Where there had been a few pennies an acre, the price rose 400%. Grain from the Basutu began to find its way into the colony in greater volume, and Godlinton launched a newspaper called The Friend of the Sovereignty in Bloemfontein to promote landed interests. Back south, the new British Kaffraria region was administered as a military protectorate, and King Williamstown was rebuilt, having been burnt to the ground during the Seventh Frontier War. It served as the centre of a matrix of British forts around the mountains, including the Amatolas, while a new port began to take shape, East London. This had become a settler enclave, and then in the census of 1848, it was found that large numbers of the Amanxhosa people remained in the Amatolas, more than 27,000, but that was less than half of the original number of around 56,000 in 1835. The rest of the Amaxhosa people that used to live there had emigrated into the Cape to work as laborers and servants, or had shifted further northeast to live in the Transkei. Makoma was now living in the region around Fort Hare, under the brow or the hog's back of the modern era. Smith had relented after the boot-on-the-neck moment in Port Elizabeth and allowed him back into his beloved hills, although he was denied retaking the place called Blinkvater. There were over 35,000 Amanhlambe people living in the northeast, while the Amankraleka people of the Transkei numbered around 70,000. As you can see, compared to modern populations, these were tiny specks on the landscape, and as regarding the settlers, they were even more tiny specks. Another of Smith's grand ideas, I mentioned in an earlier episode, was his £1 land tax levied on African plot holders to try and induce more labour for the farms and the towns. He began to fine people for practising traditional customs and reward those, he said, promoted European attitudes, such as monogamy. The missionaries loved this plan. They had been waging their own war on polygamy and lobola, which were regarded as central pillars of Amaxhosa patriarchy. Historians generally agree that about half of the Amaxhosa men and many of the women in British Kaffraria began to work in the Cape Colony itself, setting up a long tradition of people from the area and the Transkei migrating to Cape Town and other Western Cape towns to look for work during the year. Perhaps the most stark change was evinced in the surge of men working in the fields. Ancient Amaxhosa ways had had a clear division of labour, where the women worked in the fields and the men produced garments and hunted. Things were changing. One of the more odious ex-missionaries operating in this area was Henry Calderwood. He was once a London Missionary Society man, but had been thrown out for his growing extremist tendencies when it came to the Amaxhosa. He had become the magistrate of Victoria East and was a zealous flogger of Amaxhosa for minor offences. Calderwood's other favourite trick was to separate families, forcing Amaxhosa women and even children to the Cape Colony as servants and labourers. What is not common knowledge these days is that there was a great demand for children under the age of 10 to go to work in the Western Cape. Of course, this was not a proper labour environment, and the shift meant that these young boys and girls and their mothers and fathers were being turned into indentured labourers. This was a free market situation of the Amaxhosa being able to hawk their labour for a fair price, mutated. Many were told they would be paid a wage, only to find that the terms of contract were vague. They were now receiving unspecified promises, and the fabric of rural life based on marriage and female fertility and the honour of the elders unravelled. Because access to cattle became more and more difficult for the average Amaxhosa, men and women could not marry early, and the obvious effect of this was to make abortion universal. It was the missionaries and their fixation on changing the Amaxhosa ways that inadvertently led directly to this ironic result. By forcing the Amaxhosa away from their lifestyles, they increased child abuse and abortion. This, of course, was happening in other frontier regions, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, even in parts of South America, and the ancient First Peoples had been upended. Governor Smith ratcheted up the pressure on the Khoi Khoi, the coloured communities, particularly in the Cut River settlement. I've explained how important this land was, how valuable, and Smith was listening intently to people like Godlinton, yes, the journalist stroke land speculator, and other settlers who were determined to seize the Cut River settlement by hook or by crook. The new governor had decided he'd increase the pressure on these people by the month, driving them out of their settlement if he could. His vagrancy law was aimed at doing just that. It was actually disallowed by the imperial government. It was so harsh. So instead he set about managing the coloured people off their land using the old-fashioned method. Oppression. Successive magistrates raised the duties on the cutting of wood, vital for the people for heating and cooking, and also the main means of income for the Cut River settlement. Thick forests abounded their territory. They sold this wood to make a living, and the hiking of the duties turned their business into a non-starter. Just as a kind of final nail in the decaying relationship between the Cut River people and the colony, Smith allowed the land speculators to move in, and yes, Robert Godlinton found himself the proud owner of a Cut River property. If you research this period, the utter cynicism of these actions will no doubt shock you. It was not the usual process of land contestation. This was plain and simply put, grand theft. By the end of 1849 and beginning 1850, people of the Cut River Settlement experienced a government that was violently oppressive. The wood cutting may have been lapsing, but there was social tinder all around, and it was going to take the spark of the War of Mlanjeni to set the Cut River Settlement ablaze. We are heading towards many fascinating moments in South African history. The settlers, for example, were crying out for representative government. They were tired of being managed by a succession of chinless British officers who were veterans of the Peninsular War, tired of the fetters of some faraway political class in Britain, and tired of the humanitarians of the time restricting their control over black South Africans. The editor of the Zuid Afrikaan, for example, decided to forswear his allegiance to old-fashioned ethnic politics and had thrown in his lot with the British merchants of Cape Town. No more would he write about the English invading his land. He began to churn out editorials extolling the virtues of trading with the world using the English links. Of course, his former countrymen, the Voortrekkers, would have had fits at this. They would have regarded him as a sellout, to use a modern term. The English of the Cape prided themselves in a society that was less formal and more egalitarian than that of Britain, at least for white South Africans. The great urbanized Dutch families spoke Dutch amongst themselves, but were now speaking English, which had become the language of politics. It was already the language of commerce. Bilingualism was leading to intermarriage between the Dutch and the English. The Cape establishment by now was divided very roughly into five categories: military, professional, bureaucratic, landed, and traders, or the mercantile. The military were the elite, made up mostly of British officers, but their presence was periodical. They would be rotated out to India and other colonies. Then there were the professionals, a bureaucratic elite, if you like, who included top policymakers and for whom the Cape represented a comparatively limited sphere. These men wanted to run India or head home to England to take up powerful positions in government there. However, wealth, as it usually does, determined position and influence, and by 1849 and increasingly thereafter, as the Cape was to head into representative government, wealthy farmers, both Dutch and English, or the landed interest, as they would become known, led the list of occupations in the Cape Parliament. In a country lacking hereditary hierarchical structures, individual mobility was accessible to skilled whites, unlike in much of the United Kingdom. Business success ennobled one, unlike Britain, where the hereditary old money determined everything. This upwardly mobile new class of people in the Cape viewed their English-centric, mid-Victorian, middle-class values as a component of their mental baggage. A considerable number of Dutch speakers, or what were now being called local Afrikaner community, had been co-opted by the British into positions of power and authority. As a writer in the Cape Monthly magazine was to report in only a couple of years, in the colony there was no aristocracy, certainly, but the most absurd and impertinent of pretensions, that of empty heads and full purses. The snobbery of the military wives peeved the writers. Women who had perhaps never moved in Europe in other than third-rate middle-class society turn up their chiselled noses at Afrikaners because their husbands are engaged in business. The model for these colonials was mid-Victorian industrial England, where the zeitgeist was increasingly reflecting the ethos of this middle class. Vitally for our story, this ethos was based in an optimism which stemmed from a firm belief in progress, juxtaposed with an anxiety that could be called an hypocrisy as it tried to balance science and religious beliefs. We have arrived at the midway of the 19th century, and South African history was on the cusp of significant shifts. Major wars were fermenting, and the riches underground, South Africa's mineral treasure, was 15 years from discovery. Next episode, we'll hear how the very epitome of the mid-Victorian era, Harry Smith, was about to launch the country into another frontier war as he miscalculated Amakosa power. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about this episode. And you can also register for my little newsletter. Until next, goodbye.